Just shut up until I'm done.
Geek Juice Radio.
You dropping bricks on dogs?
Best fantasy movie ever.
This little boy named Bruce Wayne.
Is it raped if you enjoyed it?
Not it, Bruce, no.
Visit our website at www.geekjuicemedia.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Geek Juice Radio. Tonight, we will be discussing the life and work of the recently deceased Ray Bradbury.
Here. All this is my Martian landscape. Somewhere in this room is an African veldt. Just beyond, perhaps, is a small Illinois town where I grew up. And I'm surrounded on every side by my magician's toy shop. I'll never starve here. I just look around, find what I need, and begin. I'm Ray Bradbury. And this is...
It was Ray Bradbury Theater. Joining us tonight to remark upon the irony of us discussing Ray Bradbury on the goddamn internet instead of in print is going to be Josh Hadley.
Yes, we all get the irony of that.
Kevin Daly.
Yep, I saw the murderer episode too.
And Alex Jowski.
Yep, I'm here too.
That is some silence that can be cut out.
Yes, that is.
You're the host, Charlie. I was waiting for you to say something.
Like hell I am.
We're off to a rousing start here.
I just have a good intro voice, that's all.
Oh, okay. Well, then let me say, the man was an absolute visionary. We all grew up with his work. Even those of you listening who might not know that you've ever read or seen anything by Bradbury, I bet you have, without even realizing it. If you're an old school fan, if you've ever seen It Came From Outer Space, Bradbury wrote that. If you ever saw John Huston's adaptation of Moby Dick, Bradbury wrote that. Around Halloween, Cartoon Network always shows the Halloween tree. Bradbury wrote that. And then there's the Martian Chronicles, I Sing the Body Electric, A Sound of Thunder, which, as Jowski will probably get into, actually coined the actual phrase, the butterfly effect, that's used in actual science.
So if you've ever seen the movie with Ashton Kutcher, that's...
No.
And also, we apologize if you have.
My brother actually liked that movie. I'm still sad to this day.
And rightfully so. Not to mention Fahrenheit 451. That's a favorite of mine.
That is a classic.
Fahrenheit 451, which, thankfully, we never got the Mel Gibson version of that.
Oh, yes. I read your article on that, Josh.
It would have all been Jews.
No, this is before he went Jew crazy.
It would have all been F-bombs.
Yeah. What basically happened was Mel Gibson's production company bought the rights to the movie, and Gibson was going to star in and direct a remake of it in, I think, like 96, 97, somewhere around there. And Bradbury still had some form of creative control. Like, he basically could shut down any adaptation that he didn't feel was close enough.
Sugar, and, 451.
Yeah. And basically, Bradbury fought Mel Gibson for almost a decade before Gibson finally gave up. Because Bradbury said the script was full of sex, it was full of graphic violence, and over 200 uses of the word f***. And if anybody knows anything about Bradbury, he's got the philosophy, you don't need to swear. If you need to say f*** 200 times in a movie, then you didn't write it properly in the first place.
Well, you don't need to say it.
He was saying that Gibson was dragging his story into the gutter, and he wanted no part of it.
And who the hell can blame him for that?
Yeah, because while the 1971 version is not really all that accurate to the book, it's a pretty good film, and it got the point across. It just didn't adapt the story all that well.
I never actually saw the movie. I only read the book.
Saw it, Saw it on Laserdisc, as I mentioned last week.
That's some good irony there.
Right?
Goddamn Laserdisc, and, really?
Shortly before he allowed the publishing rights for 451 to be renewed in ebook format, Ray Bradbury had to say, "We have too many cell phones. We've got too many internets. We've got to get rid of those machines. We have too many machines now."
Yeah, he was not big on keeping up with the tech, which is, yes, that is kind of ironic that he was a science fiction author, yet didn't like the technology of the age he was living in today. That always struck me as a little odd.
Well, yeah, because it takes the fiction part out of it.
Well, and then he also, I can't remember if he sued Michael Moore or just went on a screed against him, but he was not happy with Michael Moore over Fahrenheit 9/11. Kind of misappropriating the title of his book, because while he was not a Bush backer, he did not like the book being overly politicized the way Moore was.
I kind of saw that as a tribute, though.
And I think Michael Moore meant it as one. Problem is, he didn't ask Bradbury, and Bradbury turned out to be offended by it.
Yeah.
That's always the danger of doing something like that.
But with regards to his views on technology, let's lead right into that episode of Ray Bradbury Presents called The Murderer.
Ray Bradbury Theater.
Ray Bradbury Theater.
And that was one of the, out of the 65 episodes of Ray Bradbury Theater, six of them were all original stories that were not based on a previously published work, and The Murderer was one. And I feel when that was made in like 89 or 88 or 89, he was probably just fed up with technology, and that's why he wrote that one. And anyone who's ever seen it, you can tell he's fed up with technology.
And granted, the technology in that episode is rather dated, its message is still one that absolutely holds up.
And it might continue to hold up.
Not as dated as you'd think, though. It's pretty, I mean, the pieces of technology, the visual imagery is obviously of the time, but, you know, you had the little clip phones and stuff. How, you know, that's like those Bluetooths that those jackasses walk around wearing all the time.
Well like, ideologically, I've always identified really closely with Ray Bradbury, because I am also very anti-technology. I think it's replacing humanity. I don't have a smartphone. You might notice that there have been no new Men from Cyclopolis or Gorilla Cage on those side lately. It's because Jowski tried to explain how I can upload them, and I honestly cannot do it.
The Murderer also, I mean, to me, the thing that dates it the most is the lack of the internet and the fact that they were getting junk fax. They were getting spam on their fax machine rather than their computer. That was the thing that, like, even my son giggled at. Like, junk fax, really?
Yeah, but people got that at the time.
Well, and people still get it.
My wife just from my goes, experience. That happens.
It happens at my dad's law office.
Yes, explain what a fax bomb is to your son. It was a good time.
We still get spam faxes at work. When I worked for my dad, we still got spam faxes.
Well, and then what I want from that episode, I want people to have this leech into society, the rise in sales of chocolate milkshakes.
Yes.
Every time Jowski asks, I feel like having a chocolate milkshake, I ask him what piece of electronics he's wanting to destroy.
Well, and then the random Peter Jackson homage in the episode was a little weird, too.
Actually, the reason I realized that, because it suddenly starts showing bad taste on the TV in there, and I'm like, now that's unique. Till you watch the ending credits and you see that not only that episode, but several episodes of the show were edited by Jamie Selkirk.
There you go.
Who's a co-writer and co-producer with Jackson back in the day.
That's just kind of fun. Well, okay. Let's
guess Beat the Feebles would be too much to ask for.
Well, let's get a little bit of background out of the way for Ray Bradbury Theater. We'll get into his printed works in a minute. But the show was originally made by HBO for six episodes. And for whatever reason, the HBO episodes attracted movie stars. They got Drew Barrymore and Jeff Goldblum and William Shatner and Peter O'Toole and stuff like that. And then HBO just kind of dropped the show. They didn't have any interest, and the USA Network bought it at the same time they bought HBO's other canceled show, The Hitchhiker. Right. And they created new episodes.
With Rutger Hauer?
No, that's The Hitcher.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The Hitchhiker was a boob and gore half-hour anthology series from the 80s.
Well, see, HBO had that kind of juice with the anthology series because, like, I didn't watch a lot of Ray Bradbury Theater, but I watched a shitload of Tales from the Crypt. Tales from the Crypt got some big names. Like,
we're going to be talking about Tales from the Crypt in a minute because Bradbury wrote for that comic, sort of. So HBO dumped it after six episodes, which there's also a really strange videotape you can find that's got a bunch of exclusive footage. They took three of the episodes and edited them into a movie with all new branching sequences with Bradbury introducing each one. That was not in the HBO versions. That's only available on the Strange Tales of Ray Bradbury VHS tape, which is kind of strange.
That one never went to DVD?
No. So when USA bought the show, they obviously had to make it for commercial cable television. So instead of being 28 minutes long, the show had to now be 22 minutes long. And to save money, production was moved to France. So the budgets are noticeably lower in the USA Network episodes. And they could, for whatever reason, could not get movie stars anymore. They had lots of TV faces.
It matched, though, because all the other shows on USA looked exactly the same way.
So well, yeah, it did, but it was weird because they also, in their package, got the HBO episodes, which they had to edit about 6 minutes out of each one. So every now and then there'd be a rerun of an episode that clearly has a much larger budget. And it just seemed kind of odd because it's like, okay, this one's got a much bigger budget than this really soft video thing that we're watching now.
And the commercials are notably longer. What's up with that?
Yeah. And what it boiled down to is, while the ideas were still good and the acting was still great in those USA episodes, I showed you guys the A Sound of Thunder episode.
Yeah.
Special effects were not very good, were they?
No, that dinosaur in there looked like a sock puppet.
And that's probably the best they could afford.
Point in fact, it may well have been.
Well, because they actually got the guy that played Eccles in that was actually a pretty name actor. That's Keel Martin. That was J.D. LaRue from Hill Street Blues. He's an Emmy winner.
Ah, really?
So I'm sure he did not come cheap for that episode to get Keel Martin. It seemed like they spent the money where it needed to be spent. And the special effects, I mean, you guys, when you watched it, you got the idea that that was a dinosaur and they were supposed to be fearing. If right. it looked better, would it have changed how powerful the episode and the story was? Not really.
No. Yeah, no.
No, it was a terrific episode. I love the story in A Sound of Thunder because it explains the butterfly effect. And it's not just the vague explanations of, oh, if you kill a butterfly in the past, you know, the future will change. No, it explains why.
Yeah, and it was not based on any actual scientific theory at the time, yet it made sense too, didn't it?
Yes.
It was interesting because I was watching that episode and the butterfly at the end of the boot. And I'm like, I wonder if this is the origin of the butterfly. I had to go back and look it up. It's like, yes, this story is, in fact. I mean, it's the short story he wrote in the 50s. It was the origin of it. But
1956,
this is,
I think.
This story is, in fact, the origin of the term the butterfly effect. So I thought that was cool. And I wish Jowski had given me those other episodes so I could have watched some more. Because I would have watched more of them today instead of dicking around trying to get internet videos to work.
Will you let that go, man?
Yeah, just drop it, Kevin, okay? Let
no.
it go.
Oh, there'll be no letting it go. I'm bitter.
Well, and then you also had, they made that horrible movie, A Sound of Thunder, which it's sort of got the point across, but something was lost in translation where...
It sounds like an Emilio Estevez movie.
Well, what happened was, first of all, they ran out of money. It's got some, I mean, okay, Jowski, you thought the dinosaur looked bad in that? You should see the effects in the Edward Burns movie.
But it's cut.
Oh, Edward Burns. That's a shame. I would have liked it.
Well, see, for whatever reason, when they made that into a movie, they decided... Because what I thought would have been a logical place... Remember where the butterfly effect, like the Ray Bradbury Theater episode ends, which is basically where the story ends as well, with these four guys coming back and knowing that the future's changed. I thought that would be a great first half hour to the big budget movie, and then follow that. Instead, they decided to change just about everything, and it just didn't make sense anymore, and they decided to turn it into a video game. You know, every 5 minutes, they're encountering some creature that they have a firefight with, and they sort of missed the point while keeping the point. It was kind of a strange movie.
Well, if it doesn't make sense, make it into a video game. Way to foretell the future, Jesus Christ.
The complaints against the film included its poor special effects, uninvolved performances, scientific errors, and Ben Kingsley's hair.
Ben Kingsley had one of the worst wigs I've ever seen in my life.
And
he's got like long, flowing hair.
And bear in mind, audience, that Hadley has seen almost everything William Shatner has ever done. So
yes,
he knows from bad wigs.
His hair looked better in Gandhi.
His hair looked better in Slipstream. And he had a beard in that.
He is not a sexy beast.
Very nice reference.
But see, like, the thing with Bradbury is mood is very important. Now, I know Jowski didn't get a big kick out of The Town Where No One Got Off.
Yeah,
but
that one was, I was expecting a greater, like, Twilight Zone feel to that episode. But it was
the mood was so pervasive, wasn't it? Of isolation and like this town had been left behind by history.
Yes, so, it had a good mood.
I just looked up a picture of Ben Kingsley.
I told you, he's terrible looking, man.
Anus. That is easily one of the worst hair pieces I've ever seen.
I wasn't exaggerating, was I, Kevin?
No. No, that's awful.
We're going to bring up the picture now.
Well,
okay,
guys, there's actually a scene in the movie. Now, you got to remember, they ran out of money before they were done. They still had a quarter of the movie left. So they shot big chunks of the movie on early 2000s green screen. So it's not like looking like Prometheus or Sin City. There's a scene where Edward Burns and his niece are walking down the streets of Chicago. You can clearly see the two of them are walking in place, and it's the background that's moving.
Ben Kingsley looks like Terrence Stamp's taint.
There's this unfortunate picture of Ben Kingsley from A Sound of Thunder next to Malcolm McDowell. And their hair is unfortunately very similar.
But so, like one of my favorite Bradbury movies, well, and the story as well, and it's relatively accurate because he adapted it himself, is the, I want to say 1994, The Halloween Tree. Have you guys ever seen that? Cartoon Network used to air it.
I don't think I've seen it, but I've heard of it.
It is phenomenal. Okay, if you're into Halloween at all, you have to watch this a day or two before Halloween.
It's really nice.
Every single frame drips with Halloween mood. And Bradbury narrates it, and he wrote the screenplay for which he also won an Emmy. And it's pitch perfect.
Yeah, I mean, for being intended for children, it's awesome.
Yeah, and like I said, that Emmy was deserved.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, going
back to... Sounds like a double-sided compliment because it's an Emmy, but I know what you mean.
Well, and then to go back to something Kevin said, I have that on Laserdisc because it's not on DVD. Hey, the Laserdisc has a commentary track by Bradbury.
Nice.
Oh, now that is worth getting. Is it on the DVD?
There is no DVD, I just said.
Oh.
Yeah, and it says, according to the Wikipedia article, Warner Home Video has no plans for a DVD release of the movie.
It's only on those big vinyl mirrors that we call Laserdisc.
Laserdisc, or
you can
VHS.
Get it on VHS. You can get it on VHS, but no commentary.
Right.
It's the same thing with like Something Wicked This Way Comes. The DVD, the only extra it has is a making of special and a retrospective documentary. That's cool. My Laserdisc does not have that. My Laserdisc has a commentary by the director and Ray Bradbury. I think that's cooler than the DVD.
Simultaneous or two separate tracks?
I think they're together.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm not big on making of documentaries because...
Some of them are really good.
Some of them are, but...
I picked up Office Space, the special edition, last time I was at Entertain Mart, and there's this whole retrospective with Mike Judge. It was awesome.
Well, like, the things you learn on the commentary is that The Halloween Tree was originally supposed to get made in, I think, the 70s by Charles Schulz's company.
Huh.
They weren't going to do it as a Peanut special, but it was going to be that animation studio doing it, and for whatever reason, it just kept falling through.
Which would have been awful.
It would have been.
Because to hell with Charles Schulz. I will, as soon as I have the traveling budget, I will dance on his grave.
He's
okay,
still alive.
Not a Peanuts fan. Got it.
I don't think he's still alive. If he,
no, you're, no, I think no, you're right. He died.
Yeah, if he is, then give me a minute.
No, you're right. He died recently.
Then who's drawing the comics that are in the newspaper?
They are all reruns or his archives that just were not submitted yet.
No, it's all reruns.
I mean, it's because... And the reason why, I'm sure he was a wonderful man, even though he has the last name of a Nazi. the reason why is because when he died, his net worth was something like 90-some million. And for a... unsyndicated cartoonist that kind of sticks in your craw.
Well, as far as those comics go, I don't know. Peanuts was all right. It wasn't as bad as
Family
some of the
Circus.
Other crap.
Garfield.
Nothing was as bad as Family Circus.
Family. Okay. Family Circus was not good, but.
No, and Garfield is a Jim Jarmusch film compared to Peanuts.
But I have a special spot in my heart for Family Circus because every year. We go down to Scottsdale to watch the San Francisco Giants play spring training. There's the Sugar Bowl, which is right there in downtown Scottsdale. And it's a place where Bill Keane used to frequent And they mentioned it several times in Family Circus. So it's
I didn't know they had restaurants back then.
Personal. It's an ice cream place mostly.
I can't hate Family Circus too much because I'm I'm often guilty of what that cartoon is, which is the entire cartoon of Family Circus is funny stories about your kids that you really should have had to been there kind of stories.
It's overly cutesy.
I'm not above you tell on a regular basis, Chowski.
Yes,
I'm not above sharing stories about my kid, but they always involve like menstruation or something.
Good, awesome.
I'm not looking forward to the time when my stories do that.
No, trust me, it's going to be hilarious.
So let me ask each of you guys then: what was the first Bradbury story you encountered, whether it be a film, a Ray Bradbury theater episode, one of the TV movies, or one of his stories? Or even one of the comics he wrote.
My first encounter with him was an audiobook of Fahrenheit 451.
Okay. What about you, Charlie?
My first encounter was also Fahrenheit 451. I read it in middle school. But one thing I'm seeing on this Wikipedia page that I didn't know this was a Ray Bradbury story was the Magic White Suit, which became the movie The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit. That is a huge guilty pleasure movie for me. I love that movie.
What about you, Kevin?
It was either, because I know I read Fahrenheit 451 as a 10th grader in high school, but I good chance, because my parents were huge Twilight Zone fans, it's a good chance I seen The Body Electric before I read that book. I just don't remember it. I mean, I remembered it afterwards, but cause I specifically sought out that episode after I read Fahrenheit 451, but good chance I saw it with my parents before I actually read the book.
See, I can't remember what my first encounter with him was, but he's got a very special place in my heart because I owe my diploma to him.
How's that?
Basically, my English teacher screwed me over in my, not literally, Charlie, because I know where your mind is going. My English teacher screwed me over in my senior year. And, you know, I probably should have showed up for class at some point in the second half of the semester, but, you know, okay, that's my fault. But there's the fact that he made me a deal. He said, all right, if you do, you know, this and this and this and this kind of homework and, you know, you turn these in, I'll give you a D- just enough so you can pass and graduate. So I said, okay, cool. And my then girlfriend, now wife, was present for this, as was my mom. Well, I did all that work and he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. I never made any kind of deal with you. And so I'm like, you son of a bitch.
Burn.
So all of a sudden I had to. I had to get my English credit basically in an online course. And guess what books I had to read for my online final English credit? The Foundation by Isaac Asimov, Speaker for the Dead by Orson Scott Card, and The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury.
Nice.
Oh, poor me, having to read three classic science fiction novels. Oh, no. As you can tell, I got a pretty good mark on those.
That's a rough one there, Josh.
What's that?
Why Speaker of the Dead? Because Ender's Game is so much better.
Actually, I like Speaker for the Dead better. And maybe it's because I read it first. I filled in all the details of what Ender did differently than the actual novel did, and I think my version in my head was cooler. So it was that was a weird thing reading the sequel first.
But there is no good way to explain that to a teacher.
But you see what I'm saying, that Martian Chronicles got me my diploma. And I think that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
It is.
That is cool.
That's, yes, I would love Ray Bradbury if that were the case for me.
And
that's actually why I love Kevin Smith. Simple story, different thing.
And what it comes down to is Bradbury's stories always had this certain feel to them. And like I put in my Sanity article, when I first saw the pilot episode of Carnival, even though he had nothing whatsoever to do with it, it felt like a Bradbury story. And then when you listen to the commentary, that's what they were going for. You know, it just, there's something you can't put your finger on that goes, this feels Ray Bradbury, you know?
Carnival, another badass HBO show, by the way.
Exactly.
Speaking of HBO shows, you mentioned that one of Bradbury's stories was adapted for the EC Comics.
Yes.
Was that ever made into an episode of Tales from the Crypt?
I don't think so.
What story was it?
Oh, multiple ones. It was multiple. Because here's the funny story. Turned out he worked for EC Comics before he worked for EC Comics. And he handled it like a champ. He handled being plagiarized in the classiest way you possibly could. He started seeing some of his stories in Tales from the Crypt and Weird Science and whatnot. And he's like, huh, I don't recall ever being asked for the rights for these. So he handled it the classiest way he could. He went into their office, spoke to William Gaines himself and said, "I'm Ray Bradbury, and I think my check got lost in the mail."
Nice.
And Gaines cut him a check right there and said, "Hey, since you're here, can we actually buy some of your stories now?" And he said, "Sure." So he was actually working for EC Comics before he actually worked for EC Comics.
God, what a great life that would be, man.
And come to realize, he actually did a lot of his stories were adapted for Alfred Hitchcock Presents in the Twilight Zone. So I guess those would have actually been my first encounter.
One of his, I can't remember if it's, yeah, I think it's a remake, actually. Tim Burton's first pro directing work was directing Ray Bradbury's The Jar for the 1985 version of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, I believe.
Really?
So I think, yeah, to clarify for our listeners, what you're saying is Tim Burton, even back then, was not making original stories.
He was adapting Bradbury, which had already been adapted for the original show, so it was a remake episode to boot.
Okay. So I have a question, because this always confused me. I love I Sing the Body Electric. I think it's a great episode of Twilight Zone. Why does everybody hate it? Not you guys necessarily, but why is it viewed so negatively by the general public?
Oh man, I haven't seen that one since I was a kid. I don't even remember that. I mean, I've seen all of Twilight Zone, but that one just, I don't remember that one off the top of my head.
It's the one where the kids, like, they replace their grandma with a robot.
Yeah, I think it might be as simple as just it being kind of a downer when you think about it.
It is. That was also made.
Well, that one was also made into a really bad PBS movie called The Electric Grandmother.
Oh, yes, it was.
Yeah, it was made by PBS, so that tells you what kind of production values it had.
But I guess
there aren't enough tote bags in the world to excuse that.
Exactly. My wife's giving me a sour face because she likes that PBS special, so she's sour facing me on that right now.
Because it was the 100th episode of Twilight Zone, I Sing the Body Electric, and every time it's brought up and every time I've seen it, it just gets all these negative reviews, but I really liked it. I'm just wondering if I'm missing something. I mean, other episodes of Twilight Zone are downers.
Robo Granny is kind of an odd subject for a story.
Well, I still like it. I just wondered if anybody had any insight to the general public's mind. I guess I'm asking the wrong group.
But yeah, if you're wanting the general public's opinion, then
yeah, well, the general public made Transformers 3 a hit, so I don't trust them at all.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, and then see, the thing with Bradbury is he also was one of those authors that could dance in all these different genres. You know, you'd see him doing science fiction, and then the next story he puts out is a hardcore horror tale, usually still without gore. Like, I cannot remember what title it was, but there was one where this evil grandson-in-law, he was married to the grandmother's granddaughter. Every time she left, he kept trying to kill her, and the grandmother eventually killed him and disposed of his body in the new garbage disposal he just bought.
Huh.
And it's like, that's pretty graphic for Ray Bradbury, yet it never felt exploitative. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
I will say this. Lloyd Kaufman would have knocked that out of the park.
Playing the grandmother?
Yes. Not only like in front of the camera, but yeah.
Hey, haven't you ever seen when Lloyd Kaufman played the tranny hooker that gets his penis burnt off on a stove?
Indeed.
You know, he can play that.
Jowski, what was that movie you reviewed that had Lloyd Kaufman in it?
Bachelor Party in the Bungalow of the Dam.
There we go. That's what I'm thinking of.
No, I was about to say, though, you were talking about Ray Bradbury doing horror. There was that Drew Barrymore episode of Ray Bradbury Theater, The Screaming Woman.
Yep. And by the way, for the listeners, this is E.T. era Drew Barrymore. She hadn't even become a dopehead yet.
Yeah, this is like, well, she's older than she is in E.T., so it's like Firestarter.
Firestarter, yeah.
Okay, Firestarter era Drew Barrymore then. But yeah, she was still really young.
Yes, this was back before John Barrymore was embarrassed all the time.
She's much more competent as an actress here rather than just doe-eyed, I'm cute girl from E.T.
She actually gave a pretty good performance in that episode.
The only good performance in that episode, because everybody else in that episode just irritated
me. Boy, wouldn't it have been nice if Jowski had given me this so I could have watched it today?
Damn you, Jowski.
Yes, but
I haven't seen it either, Kevin.
Because I asked him, because I got those three, and I'm like, these were awesome, give me everything you've got. And he's like, yeah, I'll give them to you tomorrow. Nope, just forgets.
He's got a full plate, he's teaching me to read later today.
That sounds like
The only way that that's impressive, Charlie, is if it's Klingon that he's teaching you to read. But, okay, Alex, you were saying.
But, yeah, and then there was... Kevin's going to get mad at me for bringing up another one I didn't give him.
Jackass.
The bowl. With Michael
Ironside.
What's really good about this, because I'm very used to seeing Michael Ironside play a villain. You know, an evil, maniacal person.
Well, he's still kind of a villain in this.
Because he looks like a mean turtle.
Well, he's a villain in it in the sense that he committed a crime, but in that episode, he is such a weak-willed person. He puts in an excellent performance. It's just this mild-mannered, paranoid man that has no confidence.
So he's you.
No, I've got a little bit more confidence than that fellow.
It's right. True. Have you ever seen his swagger when there's an impressionable homeless woman about?
No, I have not, unfortunately. I've heard about the homeless women he likes to hit on, though.
That is Barry and LaVon.
But I also liked with the show that each episode was centered around a item in his office, a memento or collectible or whatever.
That was usually whatever gave him the idea for the story. And sometimes it's really nothing that has anything to do with the story, and sometimes it is the key to the story.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't always explain where ideas come from or how a particular object gave you an idea. Sometimes it makes no goddamn sense at all.
Right. And then so, like, he has this famous quote where he says what he likes to do is he delivers exactly one half exhilaration and exactly one half terror with his stories. And he usually is pretty close to that. But you guys do not want to get the DVD set, either of the DVD sets for Ray Bradbury Theater. Somebody needs to get a good DVD set put out of this.
What's wrong with the DVD set that's out now?
Okay, now keep in mind, especially for the six HBO episodes, they cram so many episodes onto a disc. They've got 65 episodes on 5 discs.
So this is going to be like watching a video cassette and recorded an EP, isn't it?
Well, except it's all pixelized. They crammed because it was put out by Brentwood, and then when Brentwood went out of business, whatever cheap company bought them. So they needed to save DVDs wherever they could. So they cram okay, remember both Kevin and Alex, since you saw it, the murder episode, the pixelization in that? That was not from me Skyping those to Alex. That's the way they appeared on the DVDs, because they're just way overly compressed. To be fair, the episodes are all uncut, though. You know, the HBO episodes are not the cut for USA versions. So that's at least something that's...
So they're longer than 7 minutes each.
Yeah. So the DVD set is...
Older ones were like, what are they, were 20... They were full 30 minutes, and there was like 23-minute episodes from the USA ones.
Yeah, and...
Yeah, that's how you can tell the difference between the USA and the HBO versions.
They did one of the things they did do for the USA ones was cut the intro down, it seemed. So that took some of it.
Two of the episodes offhand, the town where no one got off, and the screaming woman had, like, an intro after the intro of Ray Bradbury, like a skit of him getting the idea for the story.
Yeah, the USA ones, they didn't do that at all. I mean, Bradbury was still involved. He had creative control over all 65 episodes. So nothing went on the air that he's like, no, I really don't like that. Unlike when they bought the Martian Chronicles, when NBC bought the Martian Chronicles in the early 70s. My wife is going to sneer at me because I made her sit through that whole miniseries when I was trying to read the book. God. The one with Rock Hudson and Darren McGavin. It's the most boring piece of crap.
I think that was also Bradbury's quote about it.
Yeah. Because
piece of crap.
Yeah, it was just... It was so... Because first of all, they tried to adapt it into like a 4 or 6 hour miniseries, and they clearly did not have the budget to do this. So we're talking sets in the mid-70s that look like they would have been laughed off the set of classic Star Trek. I mean, you know, clear paper mache, rocks and stuff, and it looked more like a televised stage play than a TV miniseries.
After
a
season.
Yeah, the NBC TV version of that.
Ray Bradbury presents After Last Season.
Well, and then he even had, since you guys like Fahrenheit 451, he even had a sequel story to that. Have you guys ever read Usher 2?
Uh-uh.
Usher 2 is a sequel to that, where in the Ray Bradbury Theater episode, it's Patrick McNee. He loves, you know, murder and all these old horror movies, and he's made his entire house into these. And one of the whoever is in control of the government comes in to take away all these things because they cause dangerous thought. And then there's comments about how he's got all these books, and you know those books are illegal. We're going to have to confiscate those. And he ends up eventually killing the guy from the government. But it's a sequel to Fahrenheit 451, or at least a sidequel. It takes place in the same universe, at least.
A movie I was actually wanting to look forward to is that it never happened, though. Was for years, up until Zack Snyder made Watchmen, IMDb kept saying, "Oh, Zack Snyder's directing The Illustrated Man."
Yeah, they made a version with Rod Steiger in the 70s of Illustrated Man that was just kind of, you know, being an anthology film. Like, two of the four stories were good, two really weren't, which kind of made the movie just .
Well, anthology films are kind of hit and miss. The best ones really are the ones where you have multiple directors, each with their own different visual take on a specific story.
Not necessarily. I remember, Josh, you've probably seen this, Body Bags, John Carpenter.
Yeah.
Well, that was actually not a film, that was a TV pilot.
It was a pilot for a Showtime series, but...
Yes.
I mean, they put it out in video stores as a film.
Yeah, but I'm just saying there's a difference when you go in trying to make a film, rather than just... Because that wasn't even meant to be the pilot, that was just the first three episodes edited together.
Right.
So that I don't think was meant to flow as well as, like, the Amicus Vault of Horror or Tales from the Crypt was in the 70s.
It was awesome, though.
I don't know. The hairpiece one was...
Yeah, the hairpiece one was my favorite one. Stacey Keach.
Oh.
That was awesome.
See,
I love Stacey Keach, but the story's just so dumb, Charlie. Come on.
It is. I'm not saying it's not dumb. I'm just saying I enjoyed that a lot. Like, more than I probably should have.
Remember the camel and the eye.
The eye transplant one was good. Like, that part with the garbage disposal.
My favorite part was actually John Carpenter as the host. Him, like, trying to do his best Crypt Keeper from
like
orc.
Dead corner.
And he's just, like, drinking straight shots of formaldehyde.
Formaldehyde, exactly. Yeah. That was great.
That would have been a cool series, though, if Showtime hadn't chickened out.
I guess there was no David Duchovny narrated nudity in it.
But yeah, you know, Bradbury, he did all this work that people don't know. Like, Turner Classic Movies regularly shows it came from outer space. Bradbury wrote that,
yeah.
And most people don't realize that.
The guy had a way of telling a short story, because a competent short story is pretty difficult to write, because it's easier to write a novel than a short story, because you have more room to work. You can develop your characters over time. With a short story, you have a finite amount of words and space to develop your characters into a believable people and tell a believable story.
Did you just say a believable people?
Yes, a believable people.
And he meant it.
Like Martian.
Well, which is like, the Martian Chronicles is an amazing book. And I use the word book loosely, because even Bradbury admits it's not a book. It's more like a loosely connected collection of short stories. But, you know, they are loosely connected enough that they do flow in a specific order. And some of those, you know, you'll have a light, fun story, and then the next one will be like, and the moon be still as bright, which is about, I think, the third expedition, one of the guys freaking out, taking a gun and slaughtering all his co-workers. Yet they all kind of balance out. It's really strange how it happens.
Let me ask you this. Do you think Ray Bradbury made any money from Interspace?
Why?
Because Fantastic
it was so
Voyage.
I was about to say, because it was so clearly ripped off of him.
Yeah. I mean, the premise of Fantastic Voyage has been used in a ton of stuff.
I don't think he made any money off that. And I do know Bradbury was not Sue happy.
Right.
You know, like the EC Comics thing proved, he could have done that a douchebag way and gone and got a lawyer. But instead, he's like, let's handle this like men.
Yeah.
I don't know if he would have sued over that or just kind of went, meh.
Which is a foreign concept to grown comic book artists, by the way. Doing anything like a man.
When you guys first heard that he died... Am I the only one that immediately wanted to go listen to Rachel Bloom's F*** Me, Ray Bradbury?
Oh, yeah.
I did right after that episode where Kevin broke the news to me.
Because, yeah, on her website. But, yeah, I mean, Bradbury, it's... The way I put it in my sanity is, the world of speculative fiction is worse off for not having him contributing ideas any longer.
Yeah, definitely.
Because he was one of those, because all the ones we consider a classic, and I'm not trying to take anything away from, you know, like Neil Gaiman or any of the more modern, you know, science fiction and horror authors, but you know, we've already lost Isaac Asimov. You know, we're losing Arthur C. Clarke. Harlan Ellison's going to be going soon. Bradbury's going. We're losing that whole generation. Unfortunately, the modern generation doesn't seem to appreciate them very well.
Philip K. Dick, alive or dead?
He died before Blade Runner came out.
There we go.
Best nod I've ever seen to Philip K. Dick was in that movie, Southland Tales, when John Lovitz is the policeman.
Oh, yeah.
Kills those people, and then he goes, "Flow my tears."
I don't think I've seen Southland Tales.
Well, oh, you should definitely check it out.
Yes, it is fantastic.
Comedy or drama?
It is dystopian.
It's a dystopian drama, part mystery when you think about it.
Yeah, well, it's from that fellow that did Donnie Darko.
Yeah, Richard Kelly.
Oh, okay.
And basically, it's got...
You didn't like Donnie Darko?
Not really, no.
Oh, dude.
It's got okay. The Rock, Sarah Michelle Gellar has a, like, prostitute singer. And
Porn star. It actually, like, made me like something that Justin Timberlake was in.
Yes, Justin Timberlake.
Actually, he was quite good in The Social Network.
And John Lovitz is just this depressed, murderous cop. It's the most unfunny role you will ever see John Lovitz in.
But it can't help be funny because it's John Lovitz. Like, the part where he comes up behind Shari O'Terry, grabs her chest, and just leans in and goes, "So should we or do you want to just watch a movie?"
Well, I mean, look at Mad Dog and Glory. Who would have ever thought Bill Murray could pull off sleazy mob lawyer?
I saw that in the theater. It was awesome.
Steer us back on topic. That June 5th of this year, when Ray Bradbury passed away, that same day was a very rare transit of Venus, when Venus passes directly between the sun and the earth.
He's had a star named after him, too.
Yeah. I wonder if that was on purpose.
The star or the passing of Venus?
The passing of Venus. Like, well, like
the transit
held on.
Of Venus only happens once every 243 years.
So are you trying to imply he got beamed up?
He went home? It's like the end of Men in Black 2?
Well, you guys said it,
I did not.
I am just saying that the celestial...
I know how Jowski thinks. That's the scary part.
The
Jowski is the ghostwriter for all Men in Black movies.
The celestial bodies paid their own homage to the great man.
Sure. But yeah, I mean,
calling him an alien, that's where I'm going with this.
Well, and then, you know, Bradbury, just read some of his nonfiction. Read some of the articles he wrote for various magazines. And you get like this, you get this picture of this man that didn't quite fit in with the world around him. And I think that's partially where his genius came from.
Well, who among us cannot identify with that in some way?
Right. Like, I mean, to bring up that murderer episode of Ray Bradbury Theater again, that was, I think, is more apt now than it was back in 1988. I think it's closer to being now. I mean, he was like he was literally seeing into the future, just, you know, got the tech wrong.
If you look at all the classic sci-fi from the 50s and 60s, Bradbury, Philip K. Dick, Arthur C. Clarke, all of them, you don't have sci-fi like that anymore. I mean, every once in a while you get a great thought-provoking sci-fi novel, but it is so few and far between.
Well, because back then we had sci-fi writers that, I mean, approached fiction with the mind of a scientist. I mean, when you look at, especially Bradbury and Asimov, everything was written heavily from a scientific perspective. And now people doing sci-fi are Michael Bay.
Oh.
Well, but then you also have, and you know, I put this in my Sanity article as well, that these people, you know, you don't like to say if somebody is different than us, I mean truly different or better. These people like Bradbury and Ellison and that, they do not see the world the way we see it. Their stories are just them allowing us a glimpse into their brain that we could never otherwise access. Yeah.
And Bradbury, did he coin the term speculative fiction?
No, I like to use that term over science fiction, because speculative fiction pulls everything in.
Yeah, and it is.
So I just like the term speculative fiction better.
Like, take Heinlein, for instance.
Heinlein.
Good old Robert A. We'll just call him that. he wrote a lot of social commentary, but nobody wanted to publish it. So he put a spaceship in it, and all of a sudden everybody wanted to publish it because it was sci-fi.
Yeah, well, okay.
And that's what a lot of the writers did at that time. They told great thought-provoking stories dealing with social issues, basically disguised as science fiction.
Well, and then like Harlan Ellison put it, that science fiction is the only truly hopeful fiction. Because it, what it's saying is, there will be a future. Yeah, we might all be living like maggots underground, but we'll be living. That it's the only truly positive style of fiction, because there, it tells you there will be a tomorrow. But you guys want to hear about, like,
drenched in cynicism is all.
Pretty much. But something about, like, what Jowski was saying about how they were telling real stories in a science fiction setting because nobody would publish them otherwise. Do you guys know how the original V miniseries was pitched back in 1984 to get picked up on NBC?
How was it pitched?
Well, originally it was supposed to be a straight-out adaptation of It Can't Happen Here, about the rise of Nazism in, you know, then modern 1984 America. And I think his name was Kevin Johnson, was the creator, and he's watching and he can tell he's losing the executives. And he goes, it's about Nazis, but the Nazis are aliens.
Lizard people.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh. So he had to do that to get the show picked up.
Science fiction, very big with the kids.
Yeah, but basically they had no interest. Yet he said, you know, taking out the alien angle, the bulk of the actual story and, you know, the resistance movement and the social commentary and all that never changed. They just basically changed where the Nazis came from. And that's what got it sold, because they were not interested in just the rise of Nazism in modern America. space lizards that are Nazis, that's different. So it's that sort of thing, like Jowski was saying. And Ellison used to say that about Star Trek as well. You know, you could not talk about racism on TV. You know, I mean, truly talk about it in the 60s. But you could have Bones being racist against Spock on Star Trek because he's an alien.
And what if we get that guy that played the Riddler? Let's paint his face.
Yeah, he's half black and half right side white and left side black. And he hates the people that are just the opposite. Yeah, so science fiction allows you to tell us a contemporary story in a way that no one really wants to touch otherwise, because let's face it, guys, most people aren't going to get the social commentary anyway. They just see pretty, pretty lights and spaceships.
Right. Science fiction makes social issues more palatable for a mainstream audience.
They do. Well, heck, my daughter even understood the Sneetches and Dr. Seuss. She right. Got the subtlety there.
And you know, it was a joke. In our 1 year Radiodrome episode, but you guys remember what I said about Michael Bay and how he was a genius in the Transformers movies? How, you know, it was all a societal message about how people have to transform to fit in our society, and they can't be who they truly are. And I was spewing so much bullshit I could taste it, but it was supposed to be a joke. And there are people that thought I was really making like a treatise on why Michael Bay is a social genius.
That was beautiful, man.
How do Shuck and Jive, the robots from the second one, fit into that thesis there, Josh?
Oh, you mean the racist twins?
Yes, I call them Shuck and Jive. I don't really know what their real name is.
The ones with gold teeth and their grills.
I just call them the racist twins.
I want to close out with a quote from Stephen King about Ray Bradbury's passing. He said, Ray Bradbury wrote 3 great novels and 300 great stories. One of the latter was called A Sound of Thunder. The sound I hear today is the thunder of a giant's footsteps fading away. But the novels and stories remain, all in their resonance and strange beauty.
Yeah, basically what I have to say about, like, A Sound of Thunder that King brought up there was, do not watch the movie. Check out the Ray Bradbury Theater episode, but read the story.
Yep.
The story is absolutely phenomenal.
Well, check out the movie if you want to see a really bad hairpiece on Ben Kingsley.
And if you want to see bad CGI.
This toupee on Ben Kingsley will just, it will delight you for the rest of all your lives.
It will haunt my dreams tonight.
Charlie, do you have a new Facebook avatar now?
I do not. I've been using the same one for about 6 months.
I just figured you'd go with the Ben Kingsley.
You should Photoshop that hair onto your head.
Wait until I get home. I will. I'm going to look like Terrence Stamp's taint. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to another probably infuriating for some of you episode of Geek Juice Radio. Thank you very much. Look for this and many other wonderful things online at www.geekjuicemedia.com. Hopefully Jowski will re-explain the uploading process to me, and you'll see some new comics from me. Kevin, what do you got?
Just mostly right now, Cult of Joe D'Amato with Jowski. We're this week, by the time this airs, about a couple days later, the posting for this horrible Giallo Emmanuel film will air.
Oh, no. A couple weeks from this one. The one I'm posting this weekend is Pirates.
Pirates. But that's this week. But the when this episode airs, though, because we're not... They'll air...
When this one airs, it's going to be Heroes of Hell gets posted.
Oh, that's right. Oh, great. Yeah, Heroes of Hell. Awesome.
Josh,
I mean terrible.
Josh, what do you got coming up?
More Radiodromes, more What the F***s, more Lost in the Statics. We're coming up on our 100th episode of Lost in the Statics, so we're doing what we're calling an inside baseball episode. We're going to go behind the scenes and explain like how the show came about, some of the problems we had, and you know whatnot, and we're just going to kind of talk about the show itself for our 100th.
Nice.
And at one point, we are going to have you on to talk stand-up comedy.
I can't wait for that. Jowski, what do you got coming up?
Still slogging my way through that Pure Terror collection.
You're holding up very nicely, by the way. We've got short films from Isaac's Lou Productions coming up within the next 2 weeks.
Yep. And starting Monday, July 2nd, our new live streaming radio show, Live Indeed. Nude Geeks. Premiere episode of that. Keep an eye on the site for more updates of where it's going to be.
There's going to be
a shark. They'll actually be nude. They may actually be.
It's going to have video.
And this idea is still in its infancy, but comedian Garrett Waller and I are thinking of an advice column called Snarky Answers to Stupid Questions. So lots of great stuff coming up on the website, kids. Again, it's www.geekjuicemedia.com. Keep at it. And please stay tuned for the projection booth. Thanks again for listening. Good night.
I seen the body electric. I celebrate the me yet to come. I toast to my own reunion. Where I become one with the sun. And I look back on Venus. I look back on Mars. I burn with the fire of 10 million stars.
How's the tone difference?